which is where I'm going to put this, and I have a base station as well with a modest antenna. Right now I'm talking to you on a Baofeng 5X3 radio. I'm only running a couple of watts, I don't need too much. I think I have a decent sounding heater, sounds fine.
Okay, very good, George. Okay, I wish I could tell you a source for things like this. The problem is that for the most part, there isn't one. I got into this hobby 11 years ago, and I asked the same question. It was another club, and the guy kind of rolled off a couple of repeater frequencies, and he didn't feel like writing them down or explaining them. And so unfortunately or fortunately, I spent about a month going through all of the repeater lists for Brooklyn and surroundings, and I actually made up a list of active repeaters, and I wrote a small synopsis of the type of culture and atmosphere of each repeater. I think I annotated about 14 or 15 on UHF and VHF. I labeled it The Hitchhiker's Guide to New York City Repeaters, and it's still available on the Kings County Radio Club's website, www.kingscountyradioclub.com. And unfortunately, it's about 5 or 6 years out of date. I have to freshen it up. And it's primarily for Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island and such, because I just can't pick up much of the signals in the middle of Long Island. So it's got to kind of be an individual thing. I know of no organization that organizes people in different areas to do exactly what I did here in Brooklyn. It would be great. One of the big annoyances I had when I started out in the hobby was I took the New York repeater website seriously. When you'll notice that 95% of the listed repeaters are either completely non-functional or no one answers to them at all. And so I found that list that I had to make myself of active repeaters in the area very, very useful. And I gave it away to anyone in the area. So I wish I could point you to a similar guy who did that in Nassau County, but I don't know of anyone.
Well, you know of one now, WGBZ. I did just that for Long Island and came up with a list of common repeaters from different directories. So if you send an email to WGBZradio@gmail.com, I'll send you that list.
Okay, problem solved. What do you think, George?
Well, you know, I'll give it a shot. And honestly, if you don't mind, I'll go one step further. I'm involved with Weimark very deeply. I'm currently the vice president of the organization. It occurs to me that publishing such a document would be of tremendous value to the ham radio operators who happen to live in Nassau and Suffolk counties. So if you were to send me such a list, you agree that we could publish it in the Weimark blog and put a link to it on the Weimark website. Certainly appreciate it. WB2IKT.
Sure, no problem. My email address is wtbzradio@gmail.com, and you could publish this list, and it is Nassau and Suffolk County. I live in Riverhead, so I was really on the hunt for Suffolk County, but I came up with Nassau County repeaters also. But I think you'll find that the active ones, you're already there with Weimark, mostly the active ones. But I will do my best to get this list to you forthwith, as they say.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And along the same lines and the same train of thought, occasionally I travel. you know, I take road trips in the car. And some common places I go to, which I'm assuming at least a few other folks would, some of them is travel from Long Island to Lake George, New York. And I think it would be great to have be aware of what repeaters are available on various segments of that trip. Another place where I go occasionally is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And the route from Long Island to Lancaster could get interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is there should be some means of organizing, because I'm sure you'll find the odd person in each little local repeater area willing to document their experiences, and you need some kind of central clearinghouse to make it all available.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with such a thing, and after looking at MetroCorp and the New York Repeater Directory and the ARRL, apparently there's no incentive for these folks to make sure that it's up to date. I mean, I'm looking at repeater listings that were listed before the year 2000. I'm thinking, well, come on, you know, we're 23 years old already. And, of course, I try to key up such repeaters and they don't seem to exist. Or at least they don't key up under the specified parameters. So, this man wonders how real they are. And, of course, the other road trip that I do occasionally go to is down to, Mooresville, North Carolina, where I typically would take Route 80 left to the Scranton area and then go south on Route 81, Interstate 81, down into North Carolina. And, you're sitting there with the rig and it's scanning and, nothing heard at all. And I'm just wondering, there's got to be some activity someplace along the way. And, it's just a little frustrating having a radio in the car. You wonder, why did I pay so much money for this thing when I can't have a conversation?
AC2GS, I think the problem is that doing this detective work is labor-intensive at places like the ARRL have, at this point, no interest in. It's a lot easier doing it the way all these repeater listings do it, which is they basically take a data dump from the local frequency allocation committees that never take people off the books. And a lot of times it's sort of not their fault because I guess a lot of repeater owners don't bother to cancel or have their entries deleted. They simply move on and don't think about it. But places like MetroCorp, it run excessively slowly. It took me years to get the Kings County repeater call sign changed to the new call sign. And the only way that I was able to do it is to chat with the web host, the guy who maintains the website, to change the listing on the website instead of dealing with MetroCorp. They asked for a check. Then they said they got the check too late, and they only meet twice a year, and then even after that, they gave me a hard time. So these are very stolid organizations that do very little labor. So they just pass their database to places like the ARRL and other people who are writing up a repeater list. They don't know if the repeater is functional. It might be functional, but it might not be used much. They have no time or interest in documenting any of that, unfortunately. I wish they did.
Okay. Well, I guess that's sort of what I expected you to say. I'm just sorry to hear you say it. But there should be some better method that we collectively have for keeping up to date. But in the ham radio world, I'll be honest, I have seen many stale websites, and sometimes you just wonder what can you do about them. But thank you for the information. Right now, let other people have their turn. But I appreciate the answers, and thank you for clearing that up. A topic I haven't heard before. On the 73 WB2IKT.
Okay, you're welcome, George. Tim, is that you?
It is. I'm out on a limb on this, but I want to throw out the thought.
Sure.
If we, whatever that means, continue to call this a hobby and treat it as a hobby, why would we expect it to be treated seriously? I think it deserves a rethink.
Well, this is very reminiscent of a line of conversation that we've had on TechNet, and we even had it, I think, on CQ Magazine. I actually wrote a letter to the editor and responded, and it actually got published many, many years ago, about being upset with the idea that we're being called amateurs. And the idea is we're much more professional. We shouldn't allow people to call us amateurs. And, you know, amateurs is just Latin for lover, that we love this subject. We love doing it. We love talking about it. It is a hobby to me. I kind of wonder about people who tell me that it's their lives. I think that kind of speaks of other problems they might be having. But there's nothing bad with a hobby. A lot of people have a lot of hobbies, and a lot of hobbies are very special to them and to others. So I have no problems with this being a hobby. Some people spend a lot of time on it. Some people spend no time. Some people are very generous with their time to other people and try to help them. You know, I published my little Hitchhiker's Guide to New York City Repeaters and other such things that I've written and published. And there are other guys who just keep mum. So, you know, different strokes for different folks. I wouldn't get unduly upset with the fact that this is a hobby.
I have at least that repertoire of hobby versus vocation. And I've been a volunteer firefighter for many of my years, most of them probably 45 years that, and 31 years as a paid firefighter. So it's both a hobby and a vocation and an advocation. And this thing falls in a different place for each person, and that's fine. But it's treated as just goof by most people, and I think it's something more. And or it can be when the moment arises. I think that doesn't get recognized as much as it should. And the folks that do tend to play games with, and I'm going off on a tangent, I'll let that thought stand.
Okay. Unfortunately, this is a cynical time for humanity, especially the United States. And people generally have disdain for things that they have no particular knowledge of or appreciation of. So, you know, I mean, I regularly documented really nasty representations of amateur radio on television shows. I think it was Family Guy. Family Guy had one of the characters rediscover his radio in the basement and turn into just a vegetable, someone you really wouldn't want to associate. There was, I think, NCIS did an episode where two amateur radio operators were wrongly thought to have committed a murder or something, and apparently the writer didn't know the difference between CB operators and ham radio operators because they had handles and all kinds of CB-ish type of characteristics, and they were just harmless schlumps. So occasionally you have a somewhat heroic amateur radio operator, or they're usually not. They're just guys who have transmitters in their garages, probably break FCC laws by using them. So, I mean, that's the world, unfortunately. I wish people had more respect for each other, but I haven't seen much of that lately.
No, I haven't seen this Mike example of it. I agree. But I came to radio, I came back to radio, hoping to see it as something as a community building thing, and I hope that's the direction it takes and not something else. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, I mean, to a degree, you make it what it is for you. You know, I could have simply bought a Balfunk, and you guys never would hear from me. Maybe that would be good, maybe not. But I chose this particular path, being a loudmouth. So, you know, it is what you make it, as best situations allow. And enjoy the guys who wrap themselves and in the subject and like to share it with other people. And for the curmudgeons who don't, there's a lot of antisocial people out there, both with or without amateur radio licenses. So, you know, we should enjoy each other's notions of things and these conversations that we have every Sunday and a lot of other things that, that individual hams are involved in.
Agreed on all points. I will note, however, that if by some chance, whether by sunspots, EMP devices, or otherwise, character events, regular stuff goes down, we're going to get inundated with stuff that we are not prepared for. I'm going off tangent again, but I think we got to recognize where we fit into different courses of events of history, and not think lightly of it. The thing. What the thing is, I don't know.
Thanks. Okay, you might want to look into ARIES, the amateur radio, the emergency service, I think is what it stands for, ARIES. There are local ARIES. Nassau County ARIES is pretty good. Different regions are different degrees of good and bad. It depends on who's running that particular organization. But you might want to look into it. You know, unfortunately, I have a kind of cynical view of most amateur emergency services versus professional emergency services. You know, a lot of times people seem to be looking for points and excuses for why they didn't do anything. I remember Sandy. It knocked out the New York City ARIES repeater, and they were silent for the rest of the weather event. And then when they finally were able to use, I think it was W2ABC's repeater, they spent most of their time discussing how many points they should earn because they listened to radios during the storms and such. So, yeah. But, I mean, you might want to look into ARIES or something similar.
I myself have no interest in anything similar. I don't see this system of ham radio being used to be an adjunct for that whole thing being useful. However, if in some way it could be Mrs. Smith needs a dozen apples to make warm apple pie for the Boy Scouts who are stuck out on an island on a campground when the weather turned, community based. That's my interest. We involve ourselves way too much in government. We are people in a community. I think this radio system and the other radio systems are highly valuable in that regard. They're underutilized. Oh, sorry, I stole your line here, but back to Roy.
Okay, I'll tell you another short story during Sandy. Rich, K2KNB, had I think a generator or something because. He was online talking, and the repeater was online, and he was doing relays of all kinds of things. He would do phone patches. People would contact him on their handy talkies, and he would call their business and tell them that the person was dealing with a flooded home and wouldn't be able to come in that day and such. So that to me, that's a community type of thing. And Rich should have gotten an award or something. He was tireless, working, you know, something like 23 hours a day somehow. It was a wonder to listen to him as opposed to other ARIES notes. But you can do it locally. You can do it nationally. There's a lot of different options out there. And you can do it well and you can do it terribly.
Well said. Appreciate the thought. Back to you.
Okay, thanks to everyone for their participation. I let the time slip, and I'm terribly sorry, Paul, but it's certainly time for the SpaceNet report with WS2S.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, no problem. That was good to hear Georgia, WB2IKT. Does a great job at getting these people to do these presentations for the club. Just I don't know where he gets these people from. They're just terrific. Last guy was, he went on and on about cell phone towers, cell phones, and the history of it. Anyway, there's a YouTube on that now that's on the LimeMark YouTuber that you can look at. They record all of these things right up on the LimeMark site. And, talking about LimeMark, a few days ago, they were involved with an Aries contact with the Valley Stream South High School, Mansour. So, you know, they had an Aries contact, amateur radio on the International Space Station. And they contacted astronaut Andre Morganson, and he's got a call of KG5DCZ. Of course, they don't use that call when a school is contacting the astronauts. They use different calls. Sometimes, you know, when they're a U.S. astronaut, they would use the call NA1SS. And in this case, he's from Denmark, so they're really going through the European Space Agency group. They'll use a different call. In this case, it's a Belgian call that they use. It's OR4ISS. And the school was there, and the whole school, the audience, and it was all filmed with YouTube. And the YouTuber, you know, it was posted, ARRL actually sent it out to people. If you read the some of the letters that they send, that was included in it. You know, all I had to do is click on the YouTube, and it brought it up. You can actually see a replay of it now by putting in Aries Contact, Valley Stream High School, South. It is under the name Falcon. I guess they must have their own YouTube station. And you see, there's a big picture of the International Space Station. You click on it, you can watch this whole thing. They talk about how they go about doing it. In this case, they were using a telebridge system, so it wasn't direct. They didn't have an antenna outside, but they had this telephone hookup, which connected directly to an Italy station. They were using this Italy station for the telebridge, and he was directly connected to the International Space Station as it went overhead. And all the high school students got to ask their questions, and the answers were going back and forth, and very well done. In fact, News 12 wound up there, and I saw a clip on that as well on News 12. But, you know, it happened early in the morning, so I made sure I was up for it. The actual contact was 8:25, but they were on before that. You know, you heard everything that was, you know, that they had to go through to put this all together. They go through like a year of work before, you know, the school goes through about the whole year. They all get involved with different projects. That's what NASA really wants to see. They'd like to see the whole school involved with projects and sometimes trips down to Florida, you know, for school. That was pretty good. Very good contact. Let me drop it. So you talk about professionalism. Here we have these astronauts floating around in the International Space Station for months on end, usually around 6 months. And they take some of their time out to get on one of the two ham radios that are on for the International Space Station to make contacts with schools down below. So, sometimes they'll actually get on when they're not making contacts, and if you're lucky enough to hear them as they go overhead, and actually make a direct contact with them yourself. Any comments or questions? Okay, I thought I heard one station, but I guess not. Okay, on another topic, India is really moving along with their space program, which tells me that's one reason we have to continue pushing forward with our space program. You know, we're still way ahead of everybody else, but you never know. You know, if you look behind you when you're racing, there's a good chance that somebody coming up behind you. And India's doing pretty good lately. Recently, they've landed a spacecraft on the south pole of the moon, parked there for quite a few days until it went into darkness. You know, you have 14 days of darkness on the moon. And they were hoping that it was going to survive that. They didn't have, you know, good enough heater in there or battery system. They were solar panel. They did not have an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generated to work through the whole night. But they were just happy to land there. You know, the first time that they ever made it to the moon. They joined the rest of the countries that have done it. Of course, we have done it in the USA. Russia's done it. India has also done it. So, and then China. So, I mean, they're happy about that. They also put a spacecraft to the L1 position, Lagrange Point 1, about a million miles away from Earth, to just stare at the sun and do some solar experiments. A couple of years ago, they also put a spacecraft in orbit around Mars. So they're moving along. And now just the other day, a couple of days ago, they tested a manned spacecraft. They want to make sure that when they put people in their manned spacecraft years from now, a couple of years from now, that it's going to be safe. So what they did is they took a duplicate of what the manned spacecraft is going to be like, and they put it on top of a booster, a rocket on, not a big rocket that would actually take them into orbit, but one that would just get them off the ground if they wanted to go about 6 to 10 miles into the air. And the reason for it is on top of the spacecraft they have these solid rocket pieces, a couple of them that are ready to go off if there's an emergency, and it's called the launch abort system. Sure enough, it launched successfully from India. It got up around 10 kilometers, half a mile or so up in the air. They started to separate in 61 seconds, separated successfully from booster, duplicating if there was a problem with the booster. So they know that worked. Drove, the parachutes came out, pulled out the main parachute, and sure enough, it came down and landed in the Sea of Bengal successfully. So they're on their way. Give it a couple of years, and they plan on actually putting three people in one of these spacecraft to go into orbit. They have long-term plans, just like other countries. Maybe eventually their own space station, who knows. But for now, they don't dock with the International Space Station. We don't have that agreement yet with them. If they're coming along. Any comments?
This is KE2AJU. I'm Charlie, and I'm listening to tonight's show.
Okay, good evening, Charlie. And I heard you listening tonight, and then you said something after that. I missed it. Back to you.
No, I didn't say anything. I'm just... my hand moved, and sometimes you'll hear me, but I didn't say anything else. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, when you unkeyed it, I thought I heard a voice below you. I thought it was you. Nothing. Very good. Thank you for coming on, Charlie. Okay, I wanted to talk about these engines, rocket engines that NASA is always building, and everybody else lately is building. But one problem that NASA has, or any company, is weight. Right now, NASA has these engines that they're using for the Space Launch System. Space Launch System is one that they're building that will eventually send people to the moon, or in orbit around the moon, and eventually will send another crew to actually land on the moon. You know, in the long term, from now, they would like to have everything lighter, you know. So they're always working on things like that. Right now, they're very happy with their RS-25 engines. That's what they're using now. They're using three actually old-time shuttle engines that they've rebuilt they modified and they've actually improved instead of getting 100% out of it, they're now getting 111% out of these engines for more thrust. Right now they put on three on the bottom of the space launch system, and as well as two solid boosters on, you know, one on the port side, one on the stop. Yeah, nozzles on all these rockets, no matter who they're making, who's making it, SpaceX or Blue Origin, you know, they're all very well built, but they're on the heavy side. NASA has come up with a way to make the nozzle part, lighter. And they're starting to use aluminum, and they came up with this aluminum. Looks like a regular standard aluminum that you would normally use, 60-61 they call it. But they've improved on it, and now they call it A61 RAM 2. Basically, it's got an additive to it, 2% ceramic is mixed in with it. Normally, aluminum never used on the nozzles of rocket engines. Of course, they tend to really overheat. They can't take the heat, and they can't take the vibrations, and they tend to have problems. There's also a couple of thousand pieces involved to try to put one of these nozzles together. So they've always used other materials. All these companies, including NASA, have used different types of steels, nickel-L that they use, 718 nickel-L steel that that NASA uses. SpaceX uses something else. And now they're switching over to aluminum. The reason for it is this new material that they've developed, this type of aluminum.
Looks like they're going to drop down WD2BX.
I don't know what happened. Some link broke. Maybe the one connecting Paul.
To Paul.
Yeah, I don't think it's Paul's problem. I heard a little beep that sounded like it might be the link. He might be using Plainview or Sheldon. I keep mix it up. And that just dropped out, I guess. It's just this side of Glen Oak. Because, you know, I mean, even my radio is just silent. So the Glen Oak's repeater isn't getting any signal from him either.
Okay, somebody had to time this thing out sooner or later. This WS2N. Anyway, aluminum is difficult to weld. You know, I've done it. You have to be careful in doing it. For instance, if you were going to build some kind of a tower for your antenna and you were going to weld it together, when you run a bead trying to connect one piece to another piece, you know, it looks fine. You might run a 2-inch bead connecting one piece of aluminum angle to another one. But over time, what happens is where you stop, that tends to start splitting. And over time, that split spreads and it goes all the way up the weld. So there's a certain technique for stopping that if you're going to go in one direction. And then before you get to the end, you're actually supposed to stop and go in the opposite direction just a little bit, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch. And then you grind it all down, make it all clean again, and then finish out that weld, bring one into the other. So it's difficult. And with this stuff, you could actually, you know, worry as much if you have to weld parts to the particular metal. But according to NASA, they're just making a 3D, you know, 3D printed rocket engine nozzle, all out of this new type of aluminum. It's actually working out, so I expect to see, you know, not only NASA but other companies do this. NASA does not; they let other companies take it as well. I could see this being used in the future. It's much lighter than steel. In this case, it's stronger. So we'll see. Any comments? WS2N.
Yeah, I didn't follow the whole thing. 3D printing the nozzles out of aluminum or something else?
Yeah, it's aluminum. I've welded 61 aluminum. It's your pretty much standard aluminum, like a thin wall pipe or that they use building trades. But this is they changed it. They added ceramic to it, 2% ceramic, and now they call it A. They put an A in front of it, I guess for additive or something. A 5061 RAM 2, that's what they're calling it. Anyway, this new material, they are able to 3D print this cell. You know, you look at, if you stand next to, like, say, an RS-25 engine, you know, it's huge. It's, you know, it's probably, you know, 6 feet long, you know, who knows, inches in diameter or more. It's a heavy item. If you could reduce that weight by, you know, one third or half, it's a big plus. But yeah, Frank, it's 3D printed.
Yeah, sorry about that. So the aluminum ceramic alloy, I guess, to take the heat of the rocket exhaust, where regular aluminum, I think you said, would not do that. Is that it?
Yes, that's true. That's why nobody's used aluminum for the nozzles on rocket engines. They use nickel steel. Well, there's that stuff too. It's extremely hard steel. I mean, really solid. And that's what most engines and nozzles are made out of. You know, even the combustion chambers are made out of that. But it's a really strong steel alloy that they use. This is something else. This is actual aluminum that, for some reason, they add 2% ceramic to it somehow in that metal. And the powder that they use, a laser, and heating that up level after level until it's done. And NASA had a YouTube picture of this thing firing for I don't know how many minutes. You know, it works quite well. Back to you, Frank. WS2F.
Yeah, very good. WB2BX. So, that's interesting. Finding it with ceramic to get the heat. And of course, because it's NASA, they're paying some incredulous amount of money for this stuff, no doubt. And about 10 years from now, they'll actually be ready to launch it, right?
I agree. And because they, for NASA, everything is open source. You know, some other company, Firefly or Relativity or SpaceX, somebody's going to grab this and start developing their own nozzles. That's what I like about NASA, though, because when they do things, you know, it's not a secret. Private company does it, maybe it'll be open to the public, maybe not, you know. I've seen interviews with companies, you know, the last company, Stoke, it was called Stoke. It was a great interview with this new rocket company. But then it came down to showing them the pumps, the turbo pumps that they would use for the engine. And the guy says, well, you have to cut your camera off, cut the sound off. I'll show it to you. You know, he showed the interviewer. And by the way, I think you know who it was. It was the everyday astronaut. And he had to shut it down, and he couldn't go in to look at it. Well, if it was NASA, you know, come on in, you know. they would show you everything. Pretty good. Let me drop it. By the way, NASA did do another test on a brand new type of RS-25 engine. You know, NASA had 16 engines left over from the shuttle days. 16 RS-25 engines. Shuttle used to use three of these things. Now, Space Launch System uses four. But they had 16 of these things left over. That means they have enough for four flights. You know, they just had one. They got three more left. Now these are no longer reusable, of course. for the space shuttle system. The shuttle used to bring them back, and they used to rework these engines and fly them again many, many times. No more. They hung in the drink after they launch. So naturally, they only have a certain amount left paying Rocketdyne to build new ones. So they just tested a brand new one, and they put it in the thing. Usually, years ago, they used to blow up, and, you know, problems, cracks, whatever, all kinds of problems with the turbo pumps. Now, because they know what they're doing, and now it's new and improved, and many more 3D printed parts with the new RS-25 engine. They tested it the other day. They ran it for, I think they said they were supposed to have it for 500 seconds. They ran it for like 600 seconds, just for the heck of it. It passed the flying colors, which is good. Now that's going to bring the cost of rocket engines down, you know, because of 3D printing and less research and development. Okay, so they did good. Any comments? I'm going to probably just move on to one more topic. Running out of time. WS2F. Okay, I know I've talked about the Psyche mission to the asteroid Psyche 16, they call it. That will get there in 2029. That Psyche just launched recently on a Falcon Heavy. Doing good, and one of the main experiments that I'm following is the deep space optical communications. That's the one with the infrared laser communications that they want to achieve, you know, when it's all the way out by Mars or the asteroid belt. You know, they'd like to be able to transmit to and from this thing instead of using RF. They want to use laser beams. The spacecraft is equipped with a transmitter. It's got a 4-watt laser transmitter on, you know, using infrared, and it's going to pick up a signal from Earth. The Earth transmission, of course, a big transmitter on Earth, it's going to have a 5,000-watt transmitter, 5,000-watt infrared laser transmitter. So they're going to run their first test in a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. I'll see the results on the NASA site. Hopefully that works. That'll be the first test. Just make sure it works. And then, of course, when it gets further out, right, you know, when they test it, it's going to be around 8 million miles away. You know, that's about 30 times the difference of where the moon is. So that was their record. They had a spacecraft that tested the system from the moon a while back. And now this will be like 30 times the distance. Eventually, when they're all the way out to, let's say, the asteroid belt, they'll be like 1,000 times the distance that the moon is. And they hope this works. If it works, they'll be able to transmit a lot more data. Instead of whatever they're using on RF, it'll be minimum 10 times the amount. They're hoping it can go up to 100 times the amount, depending on the, you know, data rate, data errors and all that. Minimum of 10 times the amount of data that you can get on RF, which would be great. Eventually, they'd set these things up in orbit around Mars or actually on the planet itself. And you can imagine, you know, actually having video transmissions, you know, of an astronaut standing on a surface of Mars transmitting a signal back to Earth. You know, it might take 20 minutes to get to Earth, but it would actually be a regular video transmission, and they could transmit back to the people on Mars comfortably with this type of system instead of using RF. But they want to use it for data transmission. There's a lot of data that goes back and forth to space missions, and that would be real beneficial. Especially with the deep space network, you know, you have these three areas on Earth, California, Spain, and Australia, which has these massive dishes, some of them 120 feet in diameter or bigger. And, you know, it's the deep space network. and they're quite busy right now. There's a lot of spacecraft out there. They say there's around 40 now that are in deep space. That means not in orbit around Earth. That the Deep Space Network is responsible for, you know, half a dozen spacecraft around Mars, around the Moon, Voyager spacecraft all the way out there, Horizon spacecraft, well past Pluto on the way, you know, also to interstellar space, countless spacecraft out there they keep in contact with. And you got Juno going around Jupiter. There's going to be a lot more. Psyche now, going to the asteroid belt, and eventually you have the Europa Clipper heading to Jupiter orbit. So I can envision in the future using optical systems, laser, infrared type of systems, for not only have the higher data rate, but also to take the load off the deep space network. Any comments before we close? WS2N.
Yeah, WB2BX.
WB2BXL. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I may have asked this once before, and I didn't understand the response, or we just wouldn't get to it. The laser light is, as I understand, monochromatic, a single frequency. So if you're doing very high data rates, an electromagnetic signal is just light, not a lot of frequency. Wouldn't it still become a very broad signal and have the power dissipated over, over a range of frequencies? Wouldn't that reduce the advantage of using lasers rather than RF frequencies? You have any idea, or I just totally overwhelmed my logic here?
I know when they transmit from Psyche, supposed to hit an area no bigger than the city of San Francisco. You know, it's not going to... with RF, RF spreads out, you know, even with the dish antennas that they use, you know, maybe sometimes 1.5 times the size of Earth, you know, so, you know, that signal is really diminished. So I believe that affects the bandwidth current, affects the data rate, from what I understand. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is the beam width is much narrower with a laser than it is with an antenna at RF frequencies. So even though the bandwidth of the signal, the physics doesn't, I wouldn't think the physics changes. So if you're transmitting several gigahertz data rate, even though the signal is going to be kind of broad, the beam width is narrow, you're still gonna preserve a lot of the power density. Yep. I think that's what you're saying. Go ahead. So it'll still work better than RF, even you're still gonna have some very wide sidebands. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I read, and I'm sure there'll be more about it when they start talking about this more from NASA. And, of course, the data rate increases similar to fiber optics, you know. I mean, that's nothing but light going from one end to the other without RF. And look at the amount of data you can get out of that. Well, this is the same type of deal, except it's not enclosed in a fiber optic glass. You know, it's going through space. But that's part of the problem, you know. The idea is to, you know, to try to keep this thing exactly pointed right. And they said it's equivalent to having like a little telescope and looking a mile away and trying to hit a hair, the diameter of somebody's hair. It's very, very sensitive. And the way they're going to do it I think I've talked about this on the net before, is transmit a signal from Earth, from, let's see what it is. I know they're going to receive it on the Hale telescope. They're going to transmit from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They have a thing set up over there with this 5,000-watt transmitter. And that's going to go out, and that'll be a pretty broad signal by the time it gets out to the spacecraft. Spacecraft will be looking for that signal. And when it picks it up, it's going to use that data that it's receiving to adjust its its scope back to Earth. Now it knows exactly where to point. You know, when they start transmitting with their 4-watt system, it'll be exact going to where they need to go. With the 5,000-watt system from Earth, they don't have to hit the spacecraft exact. Might be a couple of thousand miles in diameter by the time it hits the spacecraft, but spacecraft won't care. It'll just need that data that's coming from it. That's how they're going to do this. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, very good. It sounds like the technology is feasible. I think it's been tested in Earth orbit, and I think the military has supposedly been doing this for years with its satellites. It was one of these things that I think was supposed to be secret, but really wasn't. I think Tom Clancy figured it out years ago. That's how the military was doing it. It sounds like it should be feasible at much longer distances. And supposedly some researcher, I think, claimed that they detected flashes of laser light coming from the vicinity of distant stars, but that's never been replicated or proven. For whatever that's worth, WB2BS.
Okay, understood. Yeah, and it has been tested. They did a test not too long ago. Like I said, from the moon, they had a spacecraft that went out there and transmitted a signal. It was a video signal back to Earth, and they wanted to pick it up. We didn't transmit to that station. We didn't do that. I think the new Aris, the new Artemis mission to the moon is going to, I think they want to test one transmitter like that, too. They want to give that a shot. But, they did the one for the moon. Now they also are going to do one from Earth to the, like a Tedris type of satellite. Not Tedris, it's actually part of another military satellite. We have a transmitter receiver on board that. So you'll be able to transmit from Earth, I believe from New Mexico, they're going to transmit to that satellite, and then the satellite's going to retransmit back down to the International Space Station. Then it's going to go the other way. International Space Station will transmit up to the geosynchronous satellite and back down to Earth. I want to see if that works on, using this infrared system. That test is coming up probably within a month or two. The next cargo mission to the space station by SpaceX, on board they have the transmitter and receiver that's going to be attached to the space station. So once that's all done, they'll be able to test everything out, and they're going to actually try to do that. So that'll be pretty interesting. I'm sure we'll read about that when they do that. So it's the future. I mean, you're always going to have RF. I feel that they're never going to do away with that, but they can always improve on this with this type of system. RF is going to get through the clouds, for instance. Just if you have a cloudy day, you're not going to get through the Earth's atmosphere. So what will happen is in the future, and they want to keep transmitting on a regular basis. They'll have satellites in orbit, receivers that can receive this stuff from, say, Mars. It'll be picking up all the information and then retransmitting it back down to Earth on RF, being close to Earth, we'll have no problem. Or it might just wait for a clear day and then retransmit that when there's an opening. So we'll see. Communication from Marconi to ham radio to this, to laser communication. It's pretty wonderful. Anyway, we're going to close down. I'm looking at the time. Thank everybody that stood by and listened to us. Thank all the stations that participated in this part of the net as well, and as well as the TechNet. And we'll be on tomorrow night, the Club InfoNet, at 8:30 on these frequencies. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet.
AC2GS, our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet Report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were amused. I hope you'll be back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again at 8 o'clock. As always, I'll share with you a couple of closing quotes from our own Dick K2RIW. He would always end the technical net with something along the lines of, be kind to each other. It's always good advice, especially these curious days of ours. Also, I want to share you good old Epictetus, who was a Roman philosopher. It is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open and try and learn new things. Have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And as always, Slava Ukraine. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear.
AC2AJU, thank you for tonight's show. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Yeah, this is Seth. Yeah, thank you, Griff. Yeah.